This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
In the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, Master Dogen taught, in general, then, the way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. There are beings who see what we call water as a jeweled necklace. This doesn't mean, however, that they see a jeweled necklace as water. How then do we see what they consider water? What different types of beings see is different, and we should reflect on this fact. Is it that there are various ways of seeing one object, or is it that we have mistaken various images for one object? We should concentrate every effort on understanding this question and then concentrate still more. In our Bodhisattva path, we dedicate our lives to non-harming. And sometimes that means creating the lesser harm. We commit ourselves to actualizing good. And while we try to bring forth the greatest good, sometimes we bring forth as much good as we can. We have the wholesome actions the Buddha spoke of, which in the Mahayana is the Bodhisattva precepts, which bring our attention to the ways in which human beings, wherever we find ourselves throughout history and time and place, have the potential to create the most harm and the most good. We have the paramitas of the Bodhisattva path: patience, vigor, meditation, wisdom, and so on. And in all of this, beginning with the Buddha's own teachings, there's an emphasis on the mind of the action. We tend to focus, just as when we're sitting and a thought arises, we tend to focus sometimes too much on the thought, because we're enamored of our thoughts. And in the same way, and it's not that the thoughts are not important, but sometimes we put too much attention on the thought and not enough attention on the nature of the thought or the thinker. And so too with the action. And the teachings really and the practice really brings us to the awareness of the importance of all that leads up to that one moment of action. That one moment of action, like all moments, are a result of karmic causes and conditions necessary for that to take place. And so we might look at all of those moments leading up to that action as all that we're doing to prepare ourselves to bring forth that one action, which is extremely important if it's an action that creates more bondage, more confusion, more difficulty, more pain. In the same way, if it brings forth a greater degree of generosity or more open heart or more patience, more concentration, that's also important to see. The precept of clouding the mind, of not clouding the mind with intoxicants, is in some ways less about the moment of intoxication or the fact of intoxication as it is both in terms of the intention that brings us to that moment. What are we trying to do in that? And also, what happens when we're in that compromised state? Our thoughts, our words, our actions often lead to undesired consequences. When the Buddha taught about the prohibition against gambling, he talked about the culture that often is present within a gambling situation that is basically an unhealthy environment for a practitioner and that leads to unhealthy or unhelpful consequences. When our awareness reduces an action to just that action or the desire that we're trying to fulfill or what we're trying to seek, then it's easy and it almost is built into that narrowness that we don't think about or reflect on the consequences. And so our practice is about broadening our mind, opening up the space, slowing things down so that we can examine and reflect on, hold in that moment or the moments leading up what is before and what will follow. And very often when we do that, that alone changes something within us. In one sense, all of this is to help us to open our hearts, which can be so defended. When we understand that each and every person in every moment is in a ceaseless state of unfolding, of becoming, in a sense, in that moment, that we're all in an intimate and intricate web of mutual arising that is not yet clearly understood. And not being clearly understood, it's functioning in full, but we don't know it. Or don't know it clearly, and not knowing it or not knowing it clearly means we act out of that degree of lack of illumination. Everyone has pain. Everyone has been hurt. I'm imagining it's safe to say that. Everyone has known sadness. We've all at moments felt alone, disregarded. We've all, I imagine, carry regrets. And those experiences arising out of karmic causes are, in a sense, messengers. They carry a truth that needs to be understood, that needs to be intimately practiced. They can also cloud our mind in the feeling state of each of those experiences. So on the one hand, we should never disregard them or try and suppress or deny, and at the same time, when they become too important, too large, then they leave little space to examine, to understand, to reflect, to see clearly. And in that more open space, that open mind, which is our natural mind, it becomes easier to be giving and to be generous, to be less withholding of what we have to offer, be more naturally generous in that way, and also be more able to receive what others might be offering to us and be generous in that way. When we practice and really examine the nature of mind, we see that in every moment, what we see, whatever our senses may be engaging, is not purely objective in the sense that we're not seeing it just as it is. The mind brings in history, ideas, desires, and so on. So we're not seeing it purely objectively, but we're not seeing it purely subjectively either. We're not only seeing all that the mind brings to it. There is something in front of us. It's not just a projection, although we project onto it. It's in that meeting of our sense, organ, the object, and consciousness that all three come into arise, and that consciousness, awareness, is perceived. And one teacher described it as an interactive view that that functions in a very different way, a radically ecological way, he said, of understanding our being in the world, where the relational process is primary and basic. That those conditions that are necessary to have that moment of perception, that relational process, is seen as primary and basic, as in fundamental. And where, being a scholar, he presents it this way, and where ontological separation, the separation of the sense of self, of being, I am this, this is that. That way, that sense of separation, we realize is secondary and constructed. It's something that comes after and is a creation of the mind. And he says, it is hard to overestimate or overstate the significance of this understanding. It is the revolution. It is the gate to liberation. And so when the eye opens and something appears and an object is seen, is it in the eye? Is it in the object? Is it in between? And why is this important? What does this have to do with the Bodhisattva path? What is perceived is the same as what is understood. And on the basis of that, we act. And that's, we create karma. And on the basis of that action, there's result, there's consequences, things happen. Happened in the mind, happened in the sense of our developing our habits or strengthening our habits or dissolving them, happens in the world around us, in between us and each other. Thus, when the mind returns to its natural state, when it becomes more naturally clear, then what is perceived is clear. What is understood is more and more true, and the action that comes out of that is based in that truth. What different types of beings see is different, and we should reflect on this fact. When we look at the grass and see green, the green is not in the grass. This is understood in terms of modern science and psychology and neuroscience. It's not in the eye nor in the mind. When we feel love for someone, the love is not in that person, nor is it in our heart. It arises in this intimate relational process, which is primary, fundamental, and the significance of which cannot be overstated. Different types of being, what different types of beings see is different. And so we naturally think of different kinds of creatures, living beings. But what about the different types of being that live within us from one moment to moment? What different types of beings see is different. So when the being is an angry one, when the being is a peaceful one, when the being is a resentful one, when the being is a forgiving one, what each of those respective beings see is different. Dogen says we should reflect on this fact. When the mind is clear, the heart is less defended, is more naturally open. When the heart is open, the mind is more naturally calm and receptive. And to help nurture this, bring about, strengthen this natural mind, we practice atonement. Because all of us have experienced the slings and arrows of misfortune. We've all been hurt. We've all experienced difficulty in different ways. And so to accept, and we've also created difficulty. We've shot arrows. And so in atonement, to accept what we have done that has caused harm, and to accept that without any conditions, although every action takes place within circumstances which have impact and influence, and sometimes those circumstances are very challenging and have a lot to do with what led us to a certain action, the action itself belongs to us. And so to accept that and to hold that in an open hand, to see it, to face it, to examine it, to reflect on it, to repair, and to renew. That's why in so many of the liturgies we do, in Chakai ceremony, ordination, a marriage ceremony, we begin with atonement. It's a good beginning. It's a good way to begin the day. It's a good way to end the day. And it changes our mind. It shifts our consciousness. What different types of being see is different. When we atone, what comes into being is different than when we don't. Forgiveness is another essential practice. To accept what another has done to us. Atonement is specifically for what we have done. Forgiveness has to do with what others have done. And if that other is seeking repair, is asking for forgiveness, then we can meet in that place and heal what has been torn when that hurt has been acknowledged sincerely. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes the other person doesn't acknowledge, doesn't ask for forgiveness, isn't seeking repair. We can still practice forgiveness. We can stand alone within our own heart and release, choose to release and practice releasing, because sometimes it doesn't happen all at once. Release what we could choose to hold on to. And in that way, release both ourselves and the other in our mind from that bondage of resentment, of hurt. We can practice this. The memory remains, but the burden is lighter. It is beginning to be put down. When we forgive, the being of forgiveness is different. It's a different mind. And then what we see is different. That's the importance of understanding the mutual relation of every moment of perception. It isn't happening on its own. The organ of perception just perceives. The object is just the object. It's mind, it's consciousness, in which that different type of being comes into being. And that consciousness is not fixed, ever. And so through atonement, through forgiveness, through metta practices, through the practice of the precepts, many things are happening. And in a sense, in the most significant way, the world appears to be going through a transformation. The being that is engaged in those practices is seeing the world differently. It's the same world, but the consciousness that is meeting it is different. And it is meeting it on that ground of reality. And so when the Buddha taught about how that person who is trying to live in accord with reality, is living out of or in accord with the precepts, is living the paramitas, is practicing metta, is concerned and aware of the consequences of our actions and is acting accordingly, we experience less regret. And experiencing less regret, it's easier to be more empathetic. We experience others with more generosity because our own heart is open. It's not defended, it's not shuttered, it's not guarded, which within regret it tends to be. And so there's more generosity arising. And the Buddha said, when that arises, the body naturally becomes more serene, more calm, more at peace, relaxed, stable. And that brings forth a natural kind of happiness, a lightness, a buoyancy. And in that, the mind becomes calm, our meditation becomes strong, concentrated, and naturally so. And with all of that working together, our ability to see more clearly, without obstruction, which leads to a continuation of all of those other conditions, and a deepening and a strengthening. And the being who is engaged in that path is seeing the world differently than when we don't. The scholar calls this a radically ecological way of understanding our being in the world, which is very interesting. So ecology in this sense is the study of our relatedness to other beings, to our environment, a radically different way of being in relationship with everything. And to understand that that is the primary and basic way of being in the world. And that all things are like this, trees and mountains and rocks and rivers, creatures, are all experienced in the world as their type of being, and the world they see is different. And so we all are seeing what we think is the same world, but is it the same world? Or is it a different world from every being's experience, and we just project the sameness of our experience onto others? I've been reading about this research that's been going on for a while about the communication or the relatedness, the radical ecological way of being that is where relational process is primary and basic amongst what we consider inanimate or non-sentient creatures, trees, plants. And scientists have been studying these thread-like hyphae that exist underneath the ground and that connect fungi, all kinds of fungi, with plants, trees, and they create what one scientist called an underground social network, a world of mutualism. They took 130 square meter area and they discovered that every single tree within that area was connected. And that the older the tree, the more trees it was connected to. And that within those connections, they're exchanging nutrients. They're feeding each other. One researcher said it's as though they have forged their duality, their separateness, into a oneness, into a unity. And that's what we call a forest. That some older trees are nurturing smaller trees. That a dying tree might give up, sacrifice its nutrients for the good of the forest. Or that other trees might offer their nutrients to an ailing tree to help keep it alive. And so these questions that they're asking, where does one, because this goes across species, it's not just to the same species of tree. And so where does one species begin and end? The forest appears to be a kind of superorganism they speak of. And so where does evidence or concepts that we might think of as sharing or trading or even friendships, what does that mean between these creatures? And even more so between humans and plants. Some have described it as the wood wide web. This network that has been going on for millions of years. And that only fairly recently is being discovered because we just assumed, experts, assumed that we knew what was happening, that every tree was fighting every other tree for survival. It seems to be not so. What different types of being see is different. And what does this have to teach us? What are those strands that connect us? The nutrients that pass back and forth. The ways in which we offer something that from a more guarded place we might think, I don't have that to give. But as the heart opens, as the self begins to fall away, we realize vast treasures of virtues that we can offer to someone who is in need. And how do we in turn allow ourselves to receive what others are offering? Sometimes deliberately, consciously, intentionally, but all the time without any conscious effort. All the time, even when there's no specific intention to be giving, those nutrients are passing back and forth. In a way, a sangha is just a very sort of conscious way of experiencing that. The art practice that we spoke about with the residents the other day is very much about that, to just put ourselves in the presence, in the midst of where we come from, without any idea, without trying to make anything happen. It's happening already. But that when the mind is unobstructed, when the heart is open, what opens is wonder. What opens is possibility. What opens is our senses. In that moment, what type of being are we? What is the world that we're seeing? Is it that there are various ways of seeing one object? Or have we mistaken various objects, images for one object? We should concentrate on this with every effort and then concentrate still more.
Thanks for listening. Do you have physical challenges to visiting Zen Mountain Monastery or Fire Lotus Temple? The Diamond Net is a group of Mountains and Rivers Order students who are available to support your practice. We provide Dharma and other support to Sangha members facing life challenges such as illness or mobility issues. If you would like to visit the monastery or the Zen Center but need some physical help, someone from the Diamond Net can assist you. For information, email diamondnet@mro.org or visit our webpage at zmm.org and look under the Programs menu.